You're listening to Software Unscripted. I'm your host, Richard Feldman. Today I'm talking to Torsten Ball, a programmer at Zed Industries and the author of both Writing an Interpreter in Go and also its sequel, Writing a Compiler in Go. We start out talking about some of the differences between compilers and interpreters, what the trickiest parts are of teaching compilers, and then end up talking about the unnecessary complexity that seems to have taken over modern web development. And now, compilers and overly complex web development. All right, Torsten, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So you've written two books about building a compiler. So one is building an interpreter in Go, and then followed up is building a compiler on top of that interpreter or based on that interpreter as a starting point. And this is of interest to me because I'm going to be teaching a workshop for front-end masters at the end of this year that follows a pretty similar format where some other instructor has already made a workshop about building an interpreter. And my plan is to build on that and teach people how to go from that to an actual compiler that does type checking and emits machine code and all that good stuff. So I'm really curious about your experiences of making that transition from like you've got an interpreter, you've taught someone how to make that, to now you're going to teach them about compilers. Like, what surprised you about that process? What was tricky? What was really natural? How did it go?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in general, when people ask me, what's the difference between an interpreter or compiler? I struggle to answer that, to be honest. It's not an easy thing to answer if you don't have a lot of context. But I will say that it might be easier to explain on the abstract level what a compiler is than an interpreter. Because usually the explanation I use is the computer understands one language and it doesn't understand the language that you want to talk to the computer in. Say you want to make up your own program language. So what you have to do is you have to translate it, meaning take that language, translate it into the language the computer understands, and then hand it over to the computer. And people understand this. And then the question is, so what's an interpreter? And then you go, well, that's doing the thing that you tell the computer to do, but there's an intermediate program who understands your language, but also understands the computer, and then it does the thing right away. And then people go like, I guess, okay. And then they gloss over.
Okay, this is really interesting. I never thought about needing to teach the difference between those two, but it's a great point. It's like the first question people would have, of course.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the difference? So that's interesting because in my mind, like today, that definition that you just gave makes total sense to me. It's all about, are you compiling directly to the thing the machine understands? Or are you compiling to something that still needs one more step before it goes to the thing the machine understands? And when I was earlier in my career, I didn't have that mental model of what compilers meant. I always thought compiler means that you have a build step that's doing type checking, for example. And it was all about user experience as opposed to what you're doing for the output binary or something other than a binary. Like, for example, knowing that I always thought of Java as a quote unquote compiled language because it's like, oh, well, you wait for the compiler to do its compiling. And then once it's done, then I can run the program once I've fixed all the type errors. Well, what the Java C is outputting is not machine code. It's outputting JVM bytecode. And then there is a separate program that interprets that bytecode and translates it on the fly into machine code, which is what the computer actually runs. And that distinction was lost on me for many years.
The superficial explanation that I gave, I think that's where people struggle with interpreters. But when you then show them the implementation and say you build a simple interpreter for mathematical expressions or something like that, I think that might be then easier to grasp, where you then say you split the input, say you split the input in three columns, left operand, operator, right operand. And then you just say, if the middle thing is a plus, then we return left plus right or something like this. And people get this. But once you then start emitting, say, assembly or whatever else, they still get this on that level with mathematical expressions. But once you introduce control flow or something else where you then have to think, is it two dimensions? I don't know. But you have to think in, we're compiling right now. And what we output is a thing that will run later with our knowledge baked in. And that means what we see about the control flow, we can bake into the final program. And that, I think, is where a lot of people struggle. And now coming back to what you said, when I do these explanations, I always add the disclaimer. I always say, the more production ready you production grade, not production ready, you know. Production ready is anyone's, but let's say, you know, industrial grade, like the JVM, something like this. When we talk about these languages, the lines become really blurry, right?
Yeah, totally.
JavaScript, you have JavaScript in a browser. Sure, it's an interpreted language as a scripting language in air quotes here.
Right.
But under the hood, you have a baseline interpreter, the thing that interprets it right away. You have a JIT compiler. Then you have multiple stages and add-ons to these compilers that kick in at certain stages.
Yeah. On the other end of the spectrum, the reason it's called Java C is because that's short for Java compiler. And what you can say is, well, it's compiling to not machine code, but it's compiling to the bit code. And compiling is just a reasonable term for that process, even though it's still producing something that's going to be interpreted. And then, of course, that gets into the age-old question of like, well, is that compiling or is that transpiling? And then someone will say, well, transpiling is when you are going from one high-level language to another high-level language, as opposed to a high-level to a lower-level language. It's like, okay, so what about Elm? When Elm compiles to JavaScript, is that really transpiling? Because those are both high-level languages, but you could argue that JavaScript is a lower-level language than Elm, but like, but is it really? Yeah. Well, in the browser it is. It's just, there's all these, like, depending on who you ask, it gets very blurry.
I'm not a big fan of this. Oh, that's transpiling. That's not a compiler. In my second book, the compiler we write in that book is a bytecode compiler, right? It's implemented in Go. It doesn't output machine code. And some people say, no, that's not a real compiler because it doesn't emit x86, whatever assembly. But I do think it is. And when you implement it, you learn the fundamental techniques of a compiler.
Yeah.
Very bare bones, though, because it's only 300 pages. But I haven't seen a definition of transpiling versus compiling versus whatever else, translation or something, that holds up to any scrutiny and just...
yeah.
That's helpful, right? That's
right,
useful. That's, there you go. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. And now that I'm talking this through, I kind of realize that I actually have weirdly two different definitions in my head for what the word compiler means. Mm. One is like when you're specifically talking about compiler versus interpreter, then I think about it as like compiler is the one that goes to machine code, interpreter is the one that builds some other representation that's not machine code and then interprets that into machine code, usually on the fly. Whereas when I think about compiler, and I'm not talking about interpreters at all, they're not even part of the conversation, then I think about a compiler just as something that takes some source thing and then runs some processes on it and then outputs another thing. It's much more of like a special case of like a batch process of some sort.
I guess we all say it depends too much, but it really does depend on what exactly are we talking about. What's the input? What's the output? What's the host language? What are the techniques? Because once you get into JIT territory or partial evaluation, there's so many blurry lines that I think having two broad definitions is much more helpful than having 20 not making a lot of sense definitions.
Right. The thing that always gets me about transpile is it's like you have an argument back and forth about whether something counts as transpiling, and then somebody wins the argument. It's like, okay, well, now what? Like, yeah, exactly. What does that tell us about it?
Yeah.
It's like a category that exists just to categorize, and then there's no, like, nothing helpful to, to go from there.
Like you said at the beginning, I think the most useful definition might be one has a build step and the other doesn't. In most cases.
As in
cases.
Like the interpreter doesn't have the build step?
Yeah. Like you can just start the program and it runs versus you have to produce an intermediate artifact that then gets later on executed. Ahead of time versus just in time.
Yeah. A thing that I like about that is that if I look at, for example, any of these JavaScript build tools that are for like combining your modules together and like bundling and all that stuff.
Yeah.
To me, that's a compiler. It's doing the same kind of stuff that a compiler is doing. You got a parsing step. Like if you want to learn how to build a JavaScript bundler, read a book on how to build a compiler. It's like going to be about parsing and then combining things together and doing some analysis and reporting errors. And then at the end, you're going to output an artifact. And that artifact happens to be more JavaScript, sure. So if the process of building it looks like the process of building a compiler, and also the user experience of using it feels like using a compiler where you give it your source code as an input and then it takes some time to do its thing and then tells you some errors about it and possibly gives you an output. What's the point of not calling that a compiler?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think I once built a tool, isn't it? I don't know, a couple of years back, where basically it took in some form of YAML and then partially evaluated some expressions in it and produced some intermediate result that was then used. And it sounds super abstract, but I guess that's what it was. And while I was doing this, I said to a colleague, this is a compiler, basically, with this same thought that you have. And they just looked at me and like, no, are you serious? Are you kidding? That's not a compiler. And I do think with this type of stuff, I don't know what the exact picture in my mind is, but it seems like it's one of those things where you have to do it yourself once, you have to implement it, and then you have this pattern engraved in your mind. And then you start to see this, and then you can go and say, this is a compiler, or this is a database, or whatever it is.
Right. I remember this old blog post. I think it was a Steve Yegi blog post. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. Maybe I got that right.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying something along the lines of, like, once you've made a compiler, you start seeing compilers everywhere and, like, opportunities to use compilers for things. And he was actually advocating, if I remember correctly, that building a compiler, even if it's just kind of a toy compiler, is actually a really good thing to do, no matter what kind of programming you do, because you start to see opportunities to build a compiler to solve a problem that you have. And until you've built that muscle, you just don't even realize what you're missing out on and that you could solve problems in that way. And so whenever you run into those problems that could be solved quite well by a compiler, you just don't even recognize it. And you just solve it in a much harder way for yourself.
That blog post, I think the one you're referring to is a rich programmer food.
Could be.
Yeah. And that blog post is kind of what got me into compilers. Like, that was the last push, because in this blog post, he basically argues, if you don't understand compilers, you don't know how computers work. And classic Steve Yegi might be a bit of a bold statement, but then what he says, I mean, the title is Rich Programmer Food. He says, if you can build compilers, you know about parsers, you know about intermediate representations, you know about taking unstructured input, getting it into a structured form and then working with it and doing something with it.
Right.
And he said, once you know this, you can start to eat rich programmer food. You can suddenly build the things or fix the things that have been bugging you. The syntax highlighter, the formatter, your IDE scripting stuff, test runner, all of this type of stuff, where suddenly a lot of these tools seemed out of reach because we don't live in a Lisp world, right? Where every code is data and you can just, you don't have to parse it and whatnot.
I mean, some people live in a Lisp world. Well, there you go. Closure programmers will tell you.
But I mean, in general, even, you know, working on the CLI and you have YAML or JSON or whatever, it's always a little bit off limits, right? I noticed this, readers sent me these emails and they like, oh, I read your book and now I built this. And it's not always a language. It's sometimes a parser, sometimes some other CLI tool or something like JQ, the JSON parsing tool, where you can then you have little DSL and whatnot. And that is the point that Stevie made. And then, funny anecdote. I think he wrote this in 2008. I'm not sure, but I think in 2008. And I wrote my book, the first one, in 2016. And then Stevie became my manager 2 years ago at SourceGraph.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then he told me, he said, dude, Thorsten, you're famous. A friend of mine just mentioned your book to me. And I said, Stevie, you're the famous one. And he's like, yeah. And then he held up my book. He bought it. So full circle. Basically, he got me into compilers and then I worked for him or with him.
That's amazing. Wow. Yeah. That's really cool when stuff like that happens. You get to bring it back. That's nice.
Yeah.
Okay, that brings me back to the original question, because I have a guess about what is the hardest part to teach about compilers that doesn't come up in interpreter side. But I'm curious what you think it is. Like, of all the steps that come, like, after you've done with the interpreter and you're going to add the compiler stuff, what do you think is the hardest part to teach in your experience?
I think the hardest part is what I mentioned earlier. Building up a mental model of what happens when and why, meaning on the timeline of source code gets put into the compiler does something, it outputs a program, that program is then executed. On that timeline, knowing that, say you're compiling control flow, so your input program is if 5 + 5 > 8, then we print hello world, otherwise we exit or something like this. And having this source code in your program and then turning it into another program where you have to be generic and say, okay, we're compiling an if statement or an expression, whatever. And the condition is this. So now we compile this condition. And we as the compiler, we don't know that it's 5 + 5 greater than 8. We just have to compile anything. So we have to evaluate it to true or false. So then when this program gets then later executed, we know that the result of this expression will be in this part of memory. And then our program will look here, and then our program will. Basically, this thinking in terms of our program will then, that you're not doing something right now, you're putting something in a text file that then gets later executed. So the way I sometimes think about it, and it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's this, you have a template file with certain things in it, and you fill out the bits and pieces, and then later on, this gets executed once you fill out all the bits and pieces, and it gets whatever, longer and shorter.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't make a lot of sense, but I think this is a giant leap. Once that happens, and then you can explain, you know, this is how we compile strings or whatever, like normal expressions or stuff like this. I think that then gets easier. Then
okay,
maybe.
So control flow.
Yeah, control flow, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't teach any of this yet, but I worked on a little optimizing compiler in the last few years, and it has optimizations, SSA, register allocation, runtime, and it compiles to x86. And out of all of those, I think, for example, to turn this around, I think that optimizations might be easy to explain, where you can say, oh, here's a program you have redundant expressions, right? Then we do this and these disappear. Everybody gets that. But then you start talking about SSA.
Yeah, static single assignment form.
Yes. Yeah. And then you have to explain, we're only doing this because then we bake invariance into this intermediate representation. So we always know that these things are true, which then allows us later to do this with the source code. So that's a big thing that I struggled with. Register allocator, I think, is nasty, but it's localized in a sense. Like the algorithm is, they are hard, right? And nasty, and there's lots of bugs that you
I have heard that. I actually have not done register allocation. Like Rock's development backend doesn't actually do that right now. it just puts everything on the stack.
Yeah.
Which is inefficient, but easier.
I don't know. But yeah, register allocation, I think that's localized in that you can get away without it. And then you can say, at this point, this is all on the stack. So now we want to use those registers. Cool. But with that compiler too, I think a hard part again is the runtime, where you now say, we're going to produce a program that will then call another program that we will put next to it. Mm-hmm. And we will have this other program, which is our runtime, that has a function called allocate string or concatenate strings or whatever.
Right.
And because our program just adds two strings, we turn it into a program that actually calls our runtime and says, add two strings, because only at runtime do we allocate strings. So
yeah,
again, it's this thinking in terms of future state. What will happen when this program runs? What will be there? What will not be there? And the funny thing is, we won't be there. The compiler won't be there, right? We just write letters to the future, future selves, I don't know. And then basically give all of the instructions so it goes well. I think that's the same thing, right? It's this mental model of what gets executed when and how is information transported through time, maybe, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. So I was going to guess something that I just realized might actually be out of scope for the book, which is type checking. That was something that, I mean, you don't have to have a type checker in your compiler, as previously discussed. Is that in scope for the book? I don't even know.
No, it's not.
Okay.
I mean, type checking in the sense that the interpreter will say, hey, you cannot add.
Runtime. Yeah. I've got some ideas about how to teach it, but is that something you've gotten into at all? Or?
Yeah, I did for this other compiler that I built. I have the most basic of all the type checkers. Basically, what is it? Chapter 3 in the Pierce book, the types and programming languages, or chapter 2 even, I don't know, where you basically, you just evaluate the expressions and take, instead of the results, you take the types along, right? And you say, this function returns an int, that other function returns an int, so we take two ints, stuff like this. And I'm saying this coming from a place of ignorance here. I'm not really well versed with type systems, but I do think that when you read Pierce and other things on type systems, it can sound awfully complicated. And then when I build my first basic type check, and I'm not saying it's 100% correct, but when I first build it, I realized, oh, you could have done this with, you know, the visitor pattern, or this is basically like interpretation, but we just carry the types around. And I think that's a good place to start. Look, we have this little program, has a bunch of math expressions and some strings. How can we ensure at compile time that we don't add numbers and strings? Mm-hmm. And if you read any literature on type systems, nobody will talk like this, not even close. Yeah. Nobody will say, let's make sure in this little program, there's no numbers getting added to strings. Nobody says this. They basically know everything about type systems, and then they try to boil it down to the bare minimum, but knowing the full thing. And then it's like seeing one frame of a two-hour movie and then talking about that one frame, and you go, how does this fit into everything? And then they go, well, here's the full movie, you know, at the end of the book. And I think starting from a simple use case, a simple why, a simple reason, explaining this and then saying, okay, but our little program now fails when we have more complex types. So what do we do now? I think that might be a good approach.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of different ways you can do type checking. So there's like, are you going to do a unification-based type checker? I mean, that's what I'm familiar with from the like ML family of languages like Elm and Haskell and Rock. And then there's subtyping type checkers. There's really fancy ones like refinement types and dependent types and linear types and stuff like that, which I'm definitely not planning on getting into for the workshop. Kind of my plan is to do the Hindley-Milner type inference because A, it's what I know, and B, it has some really nice properties. Unless you add certain fancier features to the type system, you get principal decidable type inference where it always infers the most general type, and you don't have to annotate anything. It can just figure everything out from the implementation. And yeah, one of the things that I'm not sure how to teach yet, but I mean, I have months to figure it out, so I'm not like worried about it, but is sort of bridging the gap between the high level concept. Like I'm kind of thinking in general of going with an explanation of it's like you have a type database where each one of your expressions has like a little type ID, and that's just like a key into the database of types. And at first you're like, okay, every single one of my expressions gets a little type ID. And if you go and ask it, hey, what's my type right now? Then all the database is going to ever tell you at the very beginning of the process is, I don't know yet. It's unknown. But then as you go, you start building up these constraints, which is this list of rules that say things like, okay, well, I see that you have X is some argument that's coming in, and then Y equals X plus one. This is okay. Well, we know from plus, both things that go into plus have to have the same type. And we see that one is a number, so that automatically checks out because plus says I have to take a number. And then the other thing that's coming into plus is X. So we say, okay, well, X must be a number because it's going into plus. So you add that to your list of constraints. It's like, well, X has to be a number. And then also you say, well, Y equals that. So you say, okay, well, Y has to equal whatever is returned by plus. So maybe it's an integer, maybe it's a floating point number. You don't know which yet, but it's also for sure the same thing that X is. It's the same type that X is. So you put that in your list of constraints. So you kind of go through and then like, you know, you mentioned conditionals earlier. Like if something's inside a conditional, like if you say if foo, then blah, blah, blah. Say, okay, well, foo has to be a Boolean if that's the rule in this language, is that conditionals always take Booleans. If you want to do truthiness, now your type checker is more complicated, and leave it as an exercise to the reader whether it's more complicated for making your programming language better or worse. But let's say it's just Booleans, then okay, then that's another constraint that goes in is foo has to be a Boolean. And then finally, you go through and solve, which is basically where you go through each of those constraints one at a time, and you just start making changes to the database. We say like, okay, well, I see that X has to be equal to Y. And then the critical feature of the database is you have like a symlink concept where you can say essentially inside the entry for Y, you say, I don't know what Y is, but it's the same as X is. So go ask X. Mm-hmm. And then you have the union find data structure, which sort of collapses those. So you don't get like, Y is equal to X. X is equal to Z. Z is equal to A. A is equal to B. And then every time you want to ask what Y is, you have to do this like eight hops.
Yeah.
There's a way to crush that down when you know that you have unification. But yeah, so conceptually that makes sense to me. The problem is that I think once you're explaining that, And then you get into the implementation details of like, okay, yes, but now what happens if you call a function? There's just all these let generalization. There's all these little special case, like edge cases where it's, in general, that's the overall concept. But once you get into the specifics of certain very, very common language features, you have to go on this long tangent explaining like how to do this very specific thing. But it's like, well, you don't want to just not explain how function application works. So that's where I'm like, yeah, it seems like a challenging thing to teach for sure.
What language are you going to use to teach this?
Since it's front-end masters, I think most people will be familiar with JavaScript. So kind of my plan is to, A, have people writing the compiler in JavaScript. So front-end masters has actually been getting into more back-end stuff, but their brand is front-end masters, so they haven't like changed the name or anything.
To back-end masters.
Well, there's good reasons not to choose that. But also the point is that they're like not even limited to front-end or back-end or web, just programming stuff. But in this case, there's an interesting challenge around not only what language do you program in, but also what's the language that you are programming?
Yeah.
So one option is, I actually haven't looked at the other course, the existing one on interpreters, to see what language they end up with. So maybe I'll just start with that. But my default thought was just start with an extremely stripped down subset of JavaScript, just so it's sort of syntactically familiar to everyone. And then just say like, all you get in this language are strings and numbers and Booleans. And that's it.
Yeah.
Because that really simplifies things. Then you don't have to get into like generics. I mean, you could do arrays, but then like, now there's the whole generics wrinkle, which I'm not sure if I want to get into. Maybe it's worth it. Maybe it's not.
But that sounds good. That's what I did for my books. In the books, the language is called Monkey, but it looks like JavaScript with numbers, Booleans, strings. And then later on, just to showcase, we add arrays and hash maps. And then for my little optimizing compiler, which I haven't published, Toucan, it's even less. It's just numbers, strings, and Booleans. But I do think it is important to use a language that looks real. I think if you were to go with Scheme, for example, you would lose a lot of people. Because in my experience, people just get tripped up when they have to think about new concepts and they also have to keep the syntax in mind and then think, what's different about this? So I don't know. Using JavaScript and saying, let's add types to this. That sounds cool.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's an element of like, you're already introducing them to a whole new set of concepts. So if you can minimize unnecessary learning or unnecessary unfamiliarity, I totally agree with that philosophy, which is exactly why I was like, yeah, let's assume it's like a stripped down JavaScript subset.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the interesting teaching questions, I guess. So you mentioned earlier when you read like academic literature and stuff, or I guess like even books about like a lot of books that are written about these subjects, there's a question of what's familiar to you and what's unfamiliar. Actually, something else that comes to mind about that topic is what is emphasized and how much weight is given to it. So a criticism that I heard of the Dragon book, the famous compiler book, I've actually never read it, but I know it's well known as a famous compiler book. A criticism that I heard of it was that essentially it spends an extremely disproportionate amount of time on lexing and parsing. And if you read that book, you might come away with the impression that that's the hardest part of building a compiler or the thing that you spend the most time on. Whereas in actuality, it's almost the reverse is true. It's like the thing that you spend the least time on. If you're building like a full compiler, I guess if it's an interpreter, then it's a higher percentage, but it's one of the things that needs the least maintenance in my experience over time. It's like once the parser is done, then it gets touched very little relative to the other things for a very long time. And then also when you're building it in the first place, depending on the complexity of the language grammar, it's not like it's a trivial thing by any stretch. It's definitely like something that takes a good chunk of time, but it's not like most of the compiler, but apparently it is like most of the book. So that's definitely something else that I wonder about. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about that, like how much weight to give different parts of the compiler.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned parses and the Dragon book. I have it sitting here and I've never finished it. And I can go on a tangent here about textbooks and whatnot. But all right, the short version is it took me too many years to realize that these textbooks are not written for me, for the person sitting alone at home trying to implement something. I thought, it's me. I don't get it. I don't understand this. And the writing I find overly complex. I always found it just there's missing bits. Like, why are we doing this? What's the context here? And then somebody online, they said, look, these textbooks are not written for reading front to back alone at home. They're textbooks. They're built with the idea in mind that they will be used in conjunction with a seminar or a course or lessons or teaching assistants and slideshows and all of that.
Yeah.
Because when you read them, most of them, I'm looking at them, it's not great reading. Like, you don't have the sense that there's an actual other person on the other end who produced this, who wants to teach you something. Mm-hmm. The sense that I get is it's a person who tries to really distill their knowledge in a way that they can archive their knowledge, in a way they can put it in a book so others can then uncompress it. But it's not made to be an entertaining read that sucks people in and motivates them to build something. That's not what this is for. Or if it is for that, then I think most of them fail. But going back to parsers, this was, I think, a month ago or a little bit longer, maybe. Jonathan Blow, the game developer, who also is now or has been building a language called Jai. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Well, yeah, we had an episode about somebody who was using that language.
Okay.
He said it was the official, well, it's like, that's a placeholder name, but it's J-A-I for now.
Okay.
I'm very curious now. I wonder what that stands for, because apparently it officially doesn't stand for anything, but probably it's John's awesome interpreter. That would, it's not an interpreter, of course, but
he did a stream with, I think, Casey Muratori, and it was about parsers, and it was about why do people make it out to be such a hard thing? Why
I think that's the one I saw, because they were talking about how to do precedence while you're parsing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. This video was recommended to me and I think I watched it. Yeah.
That's what
I
heard about. Not to clap myself on the back here, but they had, or Jonathan had some good things to say about my book. And I think what he called out is, no, he just explains the goal. We have unstructured text coming in and we want structured data coming out. Here's how we're going to do this, step by step. But when you read the compiler book and you open a chapter on parsers, or I think it's multiple chapters, nobody says this. Nobody says, here's our input. Here's the thing. Here's the string. And this is the thing we want out. You know, this is what we want to have. That nobody says this. And as a reader, you go, what are we doing here? What is the end result? It's when you read documentation or you try to find out how some code works and you end up stomping on the ground thinking, just show me the struct, show me the thing, show me whatever, a JSON representation of the thing that you're talking about. Like, just show me the thing. And most books don't do that. And they don't even explain what the goal is of parsing. And then you get lost. And then on top of that, I think they do it in a Dragon book, you start with parser generators.
Oh, yeah.
And then now we're talking about using a program to generate another program, which we then also compile and then run or compiled into our compiler to then take in another program to output structured data that we can then use to produce another program. And it's...
I think in this day and age, parser generators are basically just like default a bad idea, because essentially... nobody knows the input grammars. Like, maybe if you're starting from a world where everybody knows EB and F and stuff like that, then I could maybe see that maybe it's a time-saving thing. But it's like, the reality is, name me one widely used compiler that uses a parser generator. Oh, wait. It's like, no, they all hand roll them, of course, because you get much better control, you get much better error messages, and you get much better performance. So it's like, that's what everybody does. So at the end of the day, it's like, this is something that is used for teaching, but it has extra learning curve, because it's not just that you're teaching about parsing, you're also teaching about the grammar, which most people don't know the input grammar, and then also about the tool that takes that grammar and translates it into a parser. But of course, if you're teaching that, you're not just going to be like, and it's all magic. They just write the grammar and then it just magically, no, you have to teach the concepts anyway. And so at that point, you're just doing extra teaching in order to teach a tool that nobody uses.
Like, yes.
Why?
And also, maybe it's the times that we program in, I don't know. But I mean, obviously, we all know this, right? There's trends in programming. And I do think that when my first book came out, it's been, I realized, 8 years. But back then, parser generators, it wasn't the default bad thing. I think there was still the question of why don't you use a parser generator?
Yeah, I still have heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that looking back over the last 10 years, or maybe, you know, when parser generators came into fashion, say the prior 20 years, maybe generating programs was more common. That in the most practical sense, you generate code. You have tooling that generates code for you that you then compile and execute. Versus in the last 15 years, most popular language in the world is JavaScript, right? And you have interpreted languages, and there's not a lot of build steps where you generate code. And
yep.
Coming back to Webpack and bundlers and whatsoever again, but that's yeah. all a little bit hidden under the hood. So I think the idea to say, instead of writing this program, we're going to use another program to generate a bit of code that we then include in our program, that seems a little bit wild. And when I look at one of the most popular parsing tools out there right now, TreeSitter, which is a parser generator, I think that's maybe a little bit different in that it's pretty well abstracted, where you have these multiple grammars that people define for their own languages, and then you put them into TreeSitter and you get out a bit of code, and then you have a parser. And I think maybe it's the input format. You can define this grammar in JSON. You have like a test suite you can use. It's all pretty approachable, I think. Maybe that's the difference, because people use this. I used it for my IR and my languages and whatnot to get syntax highlighting. But using a grammar and then using a make file, except Antler maybe, but using this type of stuff to then output a bit of C code, or what's the official name for the files ending in .y? You know, like the...
I have no idea.
Yeah, but isn't that parser.y, the famous Ruby? Whatever. The output of these parser generators is also not something you can just look at. Uh-huh. So it's all a little bit mysterious and hard to understand. And I think it's a bad choice if you want to teach parsing.
Yeah. This reminds me of a related topic, like speaking of JavaScript bundling and also of the thing you were talking about earlier about actually defining what is the goal. Like, we're trying to transform this into that. I would not go as far as to call a web server a compiler, even though, like, you could say, well, it takes in a HTTP request and then it compiles it into an HTTP response, because usually the main thing that it's actually doing is not just that transformation, but rather it's doing a bunch of IO and stuff in between that's much more important, like database conversations and whatnot. But similar to this trend, maybe like parser generators got popular and then are maybe falling out of favor now, a trend that I hope will continue to accelerate is this trend of backing off on the complexity of web application stack, because I hope it's like approaching a peak. I didn't really realize how bad it had gotten, because I had been off in sort of like Elm land for a long time, where it's like, well, whatever's going on the server, we're just doing a ton of stuff in the front end in Elm, and Elm's a very nice language, and so we're just having a good time with that. Evan Chaplicki gave this awesome talk back at Strange Loop, like, I don't know, 5 years ago or something like that. Mm. The talk was called The Hard Parts of Open Source, but one of the parts of the talk is he proposes an idea for a discussion system that is, you explicitly state what your goals are at like each point in the conversation, and kind of the idea is to help reduce not just flame wars, but basically like unintended bad interactions, where like basically you'll start off by saying like, hey, I'm posting this because I want to learn, or I'm posting this because I want to share something that I made. So like, if you say I'm posting this because I want to learn and someone reads this, and then you put like context to like, okay, here's my background, and then here's my question. Mm-hmm. It makes it a lot harder for someone to misread it and think like, oh, this is just some expert who's just like being a jerk. But like, if you say like, hey, I'm new to this type of programming and I have this question and maybe I'm a little bit frustrated about it, then you look at it, you're like, oh, this person is frustrated because from the language they're coming from, it's different. And so of course they'd be frustrated, and you can just have a lot better understanding. And then you respond in a calmer way than you might have if they were just like, ah, why does this suck? And then the responses also similarly have like, okay, here's my intent of the response. I would like you to clarify something, or like, here is what I think is the answer to your question.
Yeah.
Do you agree, or do you have follow-up questions? So yeah, just trying to be a little bit more explicit about intent and see what that does to the conversations that result. So nobody's built one of these, and we're like, cool, this would be a cool way to like build a big rock web app, have it be open source. People can check it out and see how we do things. So I just wrote up this little document that was sort of like, hey, here's what I think would be a good design for one of these. And I'm thinking, as usual, about performance. How do we make this CDN friendly? So wherever people are in the world, like, there's just going to be one server. I'm going to keep like the architecture really simple, build a distributed system that you don't have to.
Yeah.
I'm looking at like, okay, what's the sort of like interaction between the backend and the front end? And as I mentioned on other episodes, like kind of where my head's at this point in terms of web development is it's almost binary, where I'm like, either I want mostly static web pages that are just generated HTML by the server or even like the command line, which is how we build rocklang.org. Or at the other end of the extreme, it's like I have a really complicated UI with lots of state, at which point I want Elm. So at no point do I want like React. That just doesn't fit into any use case that where I'm like, oh, this is exactly the right thing for me. I'm like, it's a forum. The whole point is to like generate the HTML, send it over to a CDN. It's totally wild to me that the default has become, what if you made things like 200 times as complicated as they needed to be? And like now React is talking about like, oh, we need a React compiler. I'm like, if you want to do a compiler and you're going to do SPA style, you know, single page app where you have the server is sending JSON instead of HTML, you know, what's a really great compiler? Elm. And it's been much better than like whatever this is going to be for like 10 years. So it's just very strange to me that somehow we've ended up in a world where the parser generator thing is sort of a much smaller example of this to me. If instead of teaching people how to make a parser and say, go ahead and write your parser, you could teach them, well, here's how a parser works. And then also I'm going to teach you this grammar. And then you're going to feed this grammar into a parser generator, which is then going to output a worse parser than the one that you would have written by hand. You could do that, or you could just not do all that extra stuff and then end up with a better outcome faster. It feels like the web development world is in that same place where it's like, you could do all that, or you could do much less work and then end up with something that runs faster and isn't like tens of megabytes of JavaScript, as like Dan Liu had an article out recently, like measuring the, you know, the downloaded JavaScript size. That was the other thing that reminded me of this. Like, this is completely optional. Nobody needs to do this to themselves.
Yeah, I've been smiling the whole time while you were talking, just for everybody to know, because my background is that I build web applications basically all my life before getting into compilers and interpreters, or even after. And I pushed HTML files via FTP to production websites 20 years ago. And then 10 years ago, I did Rails, or 12 years ago, Rails for a long time, and then Go and JavaScript, jQuery, Bootstrap, whatever. So now I'm now doing Rust in my day job and more systems reprogramming. I kind of have the itch and I kind of want to play around with a little side project. So I started to look into Next.js. Okay. And I also started to look into all of these static site generators. I tweeted something out where I said, look, I love site generators because I do not want any server to maintain for my side projects. I just want HTML for the performance because I like it. But also, I don't want to maintain anything. And I do love my websites for my books, my personal website. They have been running on Netlify with Jekyll and Hugo and whatever it is. And it's fantastic. You push a commit, you have HTML out, sweet. Nothing else gets executed. That's nice.
And that's exactly what we have for rocklang.org. It's literally on Netlify. And it's like we were on the front page of Hacker News. Nothing went down.
Nothing happens.
It was just fine. It was just lots of people used the website and were like, hey, this is a nice website. It was great.
So I asked people, what would you use today? What static site generator, I think it was 2023, what should I use? And I don't want to maintain, I want to be able to only work with it every, say, year, once. That's how often people blog or I blog. And people replied with all kinds of things. And I looked at a lot of them. And for example, I don't want to put down a project. I'm saying this again from a place of ignorance, but I look, for example, at Astro, which is a static site generator, but also turns out much, much more, you know?
Okay.
All I wanted was, is it possible that I can have a markdown file, but have something like a front-end component in it? But I don't need any magic. I basically just want to say, for example, you have, write a blog post and then I want to say, little graphic here on hover, execute this. So I can just embed some things in my markdown. And then I looked at Astro and then I learned about MDX and server components and all of that. And I realized I don't get it. It felt like with a lot of these tools, whenever the question came up of, we could do this, should we? People went, yes, we should. You know, yes, just let's add it. There's no cost to this. We magically infer the file type based not on the file ending, but based on the third line, you know, something like this.
Right.
Or whether you have this syntax in your file. Sure. We have auto detect. Sure. This also does this. This also does that. Everything works in every file type. Let's go. And I just sat there thinking, have you ever maintained anything over a longer period of time. And again, I don't want to put anybody down. We all have different perspectives, come to the table with different worldviews and experiences. And then in my bubble, I get some waves of React Server components, and there's some noise that I hear about React Server components, but I don't really know what they are. I've now been playing around with Next.js, and it's, I don't know, it's fascinating technology, but I still don't know whether I should feel comfortable or scared because I don't know what's going on. I write components and I don't know where they executed and when and how. And then I'm starting to realize with Next.js, you have like a really cool thing, which is, for example, you write your websites in static React, JSX, TSX, whatever it is. And then this, I think, is the sweet idea. At build time, they figure out, they render the pages fully and then put it in a static, whatever, HTML, probably not. And then you don't have to pay any runtime costs for rendering. Sweet, cool. But then I tried to deploy this on Netlify and it didn't work. And I found GitHub issues and people were saying, yes, that's because, you know, Netlify doesn't support these special Vercel cloud functions, Next.js something. And I realized, functions, cloud functions.
Yeah, what?
What's going on? And then you realize there's so many layers where it tries to auto detect this is on the server, this is on the client. And maybe I'm saying something wrong. Maybe it doesn't do this. But to me, as somebody who's built web applications for 20 years or websites for 20 years, after now 5 weeks of playing with this daily, it's not obvious to me really what gets executed when and how. And it just seems scary.
Yeah. But also, like what you mentioned earlier about static file serving systems are great. I was thinking about this. It's actually like, it's weirdly a big advantage to have been around in the early days of web development, just because we actually have firsthand experience of the alternative. We actually know what it was like, what was good and bad about FileZilla and, yes. And like,
yeah,
FTPing things, not even SFTP, just straight up FTP, unencrypted, sending things up to the server. Or maybe you got SCP when you're like fancy. That sort of like development, like we had a really strong sense of what are the pros and cons of that compared to the way things are done today. And yeah, it's not like nothing has gotten better. Several things have gotten much better. For example, there was no way back in 2006, which was the first year I started doing this stuff, that you could be like, there was no Netlify equivalent. I couldn't just be like, hey, I have generated some static HTML files. I'm just going to go give them to you. And they're just going to have infinite uptime. They're never going to go down. They're going to be up there forever and serve as a HTTPS website. I don't even have to pay for an SSL certificate like I used to back in those days. All that's taken care of you. And it just is super reliable. And it's like no effort on my part. There's like zero complexity. It's great. Yes. It does a really great job of hiding all of the complicated infrastructure that goes into delivering that user experience. Love it. CDNs also very, very, very awesome. Did not exist back then. Localhost. Also not a thing back then. Like it was, if you wanted to run your website, maybe there was some way to do this. I'm sure like if you knew enough, you could do this, but at least I and everybody else I knew, the way that we all did it was we had like a development server that was at like a different subdomain. And it was like everybody who was on the team would just be copying all their files up to their same development server in real time to try stuff out. Nobody had like a little local host entire copy of the site running locally. That came later. That's also great. So lots of things have gotten better. And we shouldn't just be like, oh, let's just go back to the old days. But also some things have gotten worse and like a lot worse. And we know that because we can compare them to the other experience and take a step back and say like, is this better or is this worse? But people who are newer to the industry, and of course our industry is growing at like a very fast rate in terms of like newer developers added. So it's something like at any given time, it's like 50% of the developers are like, I forget how often it's doubling, but like a huge percentage of developers today just were not developers back then. And so they don't have that basis for comparison. So when they're comparing, like, you know, I haven't personally used Next.js, but they're comparing that to like, I was reading the docs for one of these. It wasn't Next.js, but it was something in that space, I guess, where they're doing like client and server stuff. And I'm reading it, I'm like, this is so complicated for no benefit. You know, you're right. It is cool. I mean, it's neat that like you can write something and then either it's executing on the client or the server and you don't really care which. And you're like, you know, it's cool that it can compile to something that's like static. So you don't have to pay for it at runtime. But you know what else has that characteristic? Just compiling it to something static ahead of time, like on my computer. And then I just upload a .html file. Or the like one step removed from that is like you generate it on the server and then you put a caching layer in front of like a CDN or something like that. Again, it's also not being evaluated anywhere. And you mentioned like, oh, well, this doesn't work on Netlify because they don't have the like server hooks set up.
Yeah.
Now you have a backend. You don't have the performance characteristics of something that's like actually generating static cacheable content. And yeah. So like one of the things, if you zoom all the way out, I think a really, really important question to ask is like, what is the end user experience of using these websites? And which websites have the best end user experience? I have a hobby that is really like kind of unfortunately fallen further and further down the like ranking of things I spend my time on, especially since having a kid. But I still do like guitar quite a bit. And I still, from time to time, will go look things up about guitars. And quite a lot of the content on the internet about guitars is on old forums, like, yeah, you know, from like PHP BB or whatever, these like really old school things where like the pagination is like page one, page two, etc. And when I click through those things, like the UX in terms of speed is great. If I had one improvement I would want to make to them, honestly, it's just, it would be cool if they had nicer CSS because the graphic design feels pretty dated. I think modern stuff looks nicer in terms of visual aesthetics, but in terms of architectural performance and whatnot, like if you show me one of these sites that's using like modern web development practices, almost always it's slower. It just feels less snappy. It feels like I'll see a little bit of lag when I scroll sometimes. It just feels like the end user experience got worse. Aside from people doing CSS and like visual design work, they have definitely progressed. Like that's better than it used to be for sure in terms of web development. The original Space Jam website being a notable exception, yeah, of course. But basically, in terms of like, if you were to evaluate these technologies on the basis of what is the quality of the output artifact, the actual thing that end users use, I would be like, yeah, it's gotten worse. It just is worse. I'm not even measuring payloads like Dan Liu did and looking at like, well, is it because of all this JavaScript? I'm not even aware of that. I'm not opening my network tab when I'm trying to browse this website. I'm just like, yeah, a lot of the modern websites just feel more sluggish than the older websites back before people did all that stuff. And then you also have the productivity question. It's like, yeah, you and I know from back in the day, it's like definitely got stuff done faster back then.
Well, there's a lot going on here, right? I do think that some of these tools enable a lot of things that maybe might not have been possible before. But like you, I also think I worked on a application that used TypeScript and React and was an SPA, and it even used RxJS, which I don't know how you think about React dev stuff, but man, I thought many times I could have knocked out the same feature 10 times faster in a Rails app, just spitting out HTML and just doing forms that send a post request to this without a lot of UX integration. But then I had younger colleagues and they would say about GitHub, for example, I think it's bad that it has full page reloads. What is this? I just wanted to show up. And I thought, well, if they make the page reloads faster, I don't care. I just wanted to show up snappy. But I think for a lot of people, they think this is only possible with this because I grew up knowing that this is the thing. Like we use this SPAs and only with SPAs, it's possible. And I think what's going on here is it's complex and it happens everywhere. The anecdote I tell here is because it drove the point home for me so well was last year I was talking to my tax advisor and he was ranting about the people in the tax office. I think he's 55 or even 60. He's about to retire. And he was ranting about the young people because every missing penny was a problem. And he said, look, if I send an invoice to a client that has 300K on it, and you're calling me up and saying you forgot on that last page of that 11-page invoice, you forgot on that last page these 2.5 euros, I'm not going to call my client for this. Like, let's be real. Like, he's paying me 300K. He's paying you a lot of taxes. That's not a problem. But what he said was when he started the book, I don't know what the literal translation is, the tax law code, right? Yeah. That book, that's, it's this thick. I'm holding up two fingers. It says huge, right, Apple.
It's like a thick dictionary,
really thick.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a really thick book. And he said when he started in the 70s, it was half as thick. And he said, and the world didn't come crashing down. The world still worked, even though we had half of this book. But when you're a new person starting today working in tax law or in the tax office, you look at this book and you think all of this is equally important. You don't see what has been added and what's new and whatnot. And I think that is a pattern you see everywhere. You add a rule and suddenly it becomes the baseline. Suddenly you have to argue against the removal of that rule. And what I've seen in technology is that people start now and they think, like you said, they don't even know it's possible to just push files on a server and serve them. And I think that's an actual real thing that happens over time. People forget what came before. And we can see this because I think it's a very interesting experience to go through these cycles and see which waves come and go and see what works and doesn't work. And if you haven't gone through one of these, you don't know. You don't know how it is. You can judge. You have to go through one of these cycles. Ask all of the people who argued for microservices 6 years ago. Where are they now? Or, you know, what do they think now? How do they look back and think, yep, I realized this was a hype-driven thing or it was driven by other things? And I'm starting to ramble, but I guess it's a really complicated thing. And I don't know if there's any solution to this because time constraints, space constraints, whatsoever, you would have to teach people the history of things and basically teach them everything that came before in some sense to give them a perspective. But I don't know if that's doable.
What I hope we can do with this forum project is at least show like, hey, here is a modern way to build one of these things architecturally. We want to showcase Rock, but also the way that we're setting up the server and the interactions between the server and the client and where that boundary is and how much is in what which place, that's language agnostic. It's like, that's just about like, hey, here's what we think is an appropriate architecture for this problem to get a good user experience.
Yeah.
And while keeping the code base simple so you can work on it and make good improvements. I'm really glad you brought up GitHub and full page loads because technically GitHub does not have full page reloads.
Yeah,
technically, I think it's TurboLinks or something
like that. TurboLinks, yeah. But that's also 10 years old, no?
Well, but the point is what you said was if it's fast enough, right? Full page loads. And I actually like if you go side by side, like GitHub and rocklang.org, which uses no JavaScript for page transitions. It's just all like we do prefetching, but that's just an HTML thing. So it's like the page is loaded in advance for the other pages. But like basically, like if you go to GitHub and you hit change a tab, like click on the pull request tab, you can watch a little progress bar along the top, a little blue progress bar, as it's using a network request that not a full page load, but like through JavaScript to load the new page. And it takes like a second plus to do that. Whereas rocklang.org, static HTML, you just click and it's granted and it's instant, right? It is fair to note that this is not static content. The pull request page for any project is constantly being updated with new content is coming out. So fair enough, it is apples to oranges. But the thing that's making that slow is not whether or not it's a full page transition. The thing that's making that slow is almost certainly database stuff. It's like you're waiting on the database, you know, do the thing, assuming that the rendering is sufficiently fast, which for that page, I would kind of hope it is. But none of the modern complexity of web development is helping with that problem. It's like the reason that that feels slow, and if people are perceiving it to be a full page load or complaining about it being that way, the thing that's making it slow is not something that any of this stack complexity is helping with, and it's probably hurting it, if anything. Like, if you want to try to make that experience better for people, then almost certainly what you should be doing is figuring out how to, A, like, make the database queries more efficient. I'm sure GitHub has thought about this. It's not like they're like, oh, really? You want to make your database queries faster? You don't say.
Yeah.
But then also, I mean, minimizing non-database stuff, like, make that as inexpensive as possible. Like, once you get the stuff back, how do you render the HTML, whether that's in the client or the server? Takes time to do that. And if you can do that as fast as possible, then you're minimizing the extra overhead. I also think it's interesting to think about why did people start making single page apps in the first place? And I think there's two big factors that come to mind. Aside from, I have heard people make the point that maybe it was just kind of a hype thing, like microservices, where like big companies said they were doing it and everybody's like, oh, we got to do what they're doing. But it's understandable why companies would have started doing this in the first place. So I remember when React first came out, one of the motivating use cases that they talked about that they'd been really struggling with at Facebook and that React helped solve was Facebook would have all of these sort of different like widgets that could be active on the screen at one time. So you'd have like a little messages feed, and that was apparently a big source of problems. And you could have like a video playing. And as you switch between quote unquote pages on the site, you needed the messages to stay up there and still be active and like, you know, available in real time. You didn't want to like have that flashing in and out, and you could have like a menu open and things like that. So Facebook was a website that had a ton of interactions that needed to stay active on the client. And it was pretty important not to do a page reload for the user experience. almost no websites have that. Like, that's just not a normal use case. Yeah. That's like a very Facebook specific thing. But a lot of people, again, look, take their cues from bigger companies. And so Facebook talks about, hey, we have this technology that solves our problem. And people think, oh, well, if it's good enough for Facebook, it's got to be good enough for me. But without maybe realizing, okay, but maybe there's downsides that I don't want. But another thing that was happening a lot was mobile was getting big. And so you went from this world where you're like, well, previously I could just render HTML and send it directly to the browser. And that made a lot of sense. But now you're saying, well, okay, but I'm not going to render HTML and send it to Android or render it HTML and send it to iOS. They want something less web specific like JSON so that they can do their thing. And so then you get into the question of like, well, what if instead of duplicating my stuff multiple times, I just write one JSON API for web and mobile, and then I can just have code sharing between them. And then all I have to do is to write my front end in JavaScript. But of course, the thing that that misses is that you still have to write all the logic to generate the HTML. You're just now writing that and you have a JSON API to go with it. Whether you're writing that on the server or on the client, you're still responsible for all that code. It's just actually an extra layer of complexity. So you have not actually made your life simpler by doing this, which didn't occur to me at the time. But in hindsight, it's like, oh yeah, no, like somebody still has to write all the same code to generate the HTML. That still has to happen. It's just a question of, is it being generated on the server straight from the database, or is it on the client in response to JSON? And again, if you have a super complicated front end with lots of state and stuff like that, which I've worked on plenty of projects that benefited a ton from Elm being really good at that, then it totally makes sense to do something more complicated on the front end. But I've also worked on projects where I'm like, do you need any kind of state management solution on the front end? It's like, no, the DOM does that for you. What do you mean state management solution?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think I saw that happen where 12 years ago, whatever, 14 years ago, Rails, whatever, anything else, Django, you would have all of these fancy template languages, right? Remember, was it Haml? Haml?
Oh, sure,
Yeah.
I use Haml, yeah.
Yeah, so you had all of these and you would just generate stuff on the backend, and it was pretty sweet. Like, you had access to your helpers, you had components and stuff like this, and then you would, in DHH words, right, sprinkle JavaScript on top.
Yeah.
Then it started to morph into, oh, the jQuery explodes, so now we use Backbone because we kind of want to do more than just this. And then people started falling to this other thing. But I do think what you said about, oh, now we have to do the same thing for mobile, for the iOS app, or we have to do it for Android, and now we have an API. So you know what? Let's have an API for all of us, and let's have this. And I think on top of that, which is the same thing with microservices, you have the social component of, you have front-end engineers that maybe don't want to do back-end. They don't want to generate stuff on the back-end. They only want to do HTML and CSS and JavaScript back then.
Sure.
So now you start to say, okay, let's draw a line here and say, this is the API. It gets generated by this team over there in this room. And here we have two other rooms. That's iOS and this is the web team. And then you start to put in these boundaries based on social constraints and not on technological constraints. And that is still tricky, right? Now we've gone full circle, right? In Next.js, now we say, look, like all of these people, they now, let's give them server components. Let's push that stuff to the server because the front-end people actually want to build server components. And I don't know. It seems awfully complicated, everything. Maybe I'm super ignorant. Maybe I'm missing things where people use these frameworks to build these large commercial websites with perfect SEO and optimizations and CMS, whatever on top, and admin backend and all of this. And you have 5,000 people working on the online store for something.com, and it has to use all of this, maybe. But I don't see a 10x jump in productivity over the last 10 years. I still think Rails is super fast and it's super easy to get started, you know, just coming from the back end, just to build a static CRUD page. That's still pretty easy, you know, if you want to put stuff in a database and whatnot. And I don't see that, you know, no, we built this with this framework and actually start on the front end and then we push the stuff down to the back end and we built this. And then I don't see how this is 10x faster. And taking the complexity into account and how much you have to learn. And, you know, we all know Rich Hickey, you know, simple made easy. You know, this stuff is not simple. It might be easy, right?
Yeah.
But it's not simple. It's the opposite of simple. It's all complected, right? It's all tangled together.
Things being tangled together, yes, that don't need to be.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And I don't know. Maybe I'm becoming an angry old man, but maybe this is just what happens, right? People, every 10 years, there's a new generation of people who say, you know, this is not that much better.
Yeah. Well, but I think I don't lose hope that for the future, I think that having recognized this pattern, we can push back against it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And say,
yeah,
you know, like, hey, you don't have to do all this. Actually, and I think a reasonable response to that, especially from somebody who like has relatively new to the industry and like this is all they've ever known, is it's like, okay, well, what do you think we should do instead? So I guess increasing the amount of resources out there where it's like, look, this is specifically what to do instead. And look at all these benefits that it has.
Yeah.
Life is easier. It's a better end user experience. Everything's faster, more lightweight. I want to go back to one thing you said about the social aspect of this. And I think actually the ultimate expression of that, because Conway's Law is a huge, it's a real thing. I mean, it's yeah, obviously like, you know, people do shift their org chart. It's a natural human thing to do. GraphQL, I think, is the ultimate expression of this, where it's like, this is a technology where the purpose is to say the front end team can express not just in written down specification, but in an actual machine readable format. This is the data I need. I don't care how you get it to me, but back end team, please get this to me. And as it happens, that's also like potentially a cool format for APIs to access, like public APIs, which is kind of a separate thing. But personally, I've never implemented one of those, so I don't have any data points on like what are the pros and cons of using GraphQL versus alternatives for that use case. But it is certainly an indication of like, you're right. Once you've got like, there's a back-end team and then you've got a front-end team, and I've certainly worked in teams that do that. Well, you probably divide it into back-end, like server-side team, and then you have mobile front-end and you're like Android, iOS, and then web front-end teams. That's a logical way to organize a group. And it would be weird if it's like, well, one team is responsible for like back-end plus web front-end kind of combined, but then like that's not how it's done on the other front-ends where there's more isolation. Like, okay, like fair enough, understandable. But at the same time, you also have to look at what's the cost of organizing it that way. Like, if you do have a front end team where like everybody is like, all I do is write JavaScript and CSS and I don't touch the back end at all, fair enough. But just because you want to organize the teams that way, does that mean that you have to specifically say those teams live in the browser? Or for example, could you say, yeah, this is the quote unquote front end team, but guess what? They write server code. That's where they render their HTML. So that there's not this sort of forced intermediary of JSON, this like extra hoop to jump through. Speaking of Evan Chaplicki, he also kind of mentioned at the end of his last Strange Loop talk, at the last Strange Loop ever, but he's been working on something that was sort of even further simplification, which is like, what if you just sort of cut out the middleman of the web server and just said like, if you're going to say sort of a thick front end, like written in Elm, that's like very focus on user interactions and whatnot, and then it just goes back to the server for data, basically, then the ultimate thin web server is one that is just a database. And then it has like a little like authentication layer on top of it. And it's like, why do you need a thing that talks to the database? Why don't you just have the front end talk directly to the database with authentication so you're not, people can't access everyone else's data, et cetera. And he built a thing that does that. And that seems like another reasonable direction to go. It's like, if you have at least two points that need to talk to each other, then like that's a way you can go. Or you can say it's just the server talking to the database and then maybe a little bit of JavaScript sprinkled on top of that. But just in order to make our org chart work this way, we're going to create an entire team of people who are writing JavaScript, not necessarily because that's the best way to architect this system for end users or for the complexity of our code base, but just because, well, that way it at least mirrors the iOS and Android and isn't that neat and tidy.
Yeah. That example with it's just a thin wrap around the database, that makes me think that I think there was, I don't know, there was an important point in the last 10 years where we started with building web applications. And like you said earlier, a web application, isn't it a compiler? It takes an input, like it takes a request and turns out a response. I think I grew up in this model of request response. This is how I started to build websites. And let's gloss over some details, but for my intents and purposes, it was always stateless. I never had to worry about keeping anything somewhere in memory, something, because a request comes in, you do your thing, request goes out. Mm-hmm. That's the lifetime of my program, basically, right? Leaving some details out. So I never really thought about longer lived applications because I only ever worked on web applications or CLI tools and stuff like this. And then when we started to introduce SPAs and people wanted to avoid these page reloads, suddenly we emerged into this land of, oh, now we have client-side state and we have long-lived client-side applications.
Right.
And, oh, wait, if I change the page, I still have all of the state lying around and I have to manage all of this. And I think that actually snuck up on people. I don't think the web community, whatever, they went with, hey, you know what? Let's build a client application. Let's build fat clients that keep state like a native application where you have to keep state and you don't have to leak memory and blah, 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 blah. And I think that was a big shift where then people realized, oh boy, like this is more complicated than we thought. And then maybe it was, you know, sunken cost fallacy. I don't know. Let's go all the way there, you know, and embrace this. But I do think that's a big thing that people forget, that what you said, when you lean into this model of let's have a really fat client and a really thin backend, then you're in one mode where you have to have everything on the client and the backend doesn't play a role. When you go fat backend, usually you can work with request response and it gets you a long way, right? Leaving aside the database and whatnot, which is your state. But in the middle is where things start to become right. really complicated, where you have to keep state on the client and you have to fetch in state from the database. And I feel like that's not really taught. That's not really something that people talk about when you read beginner books on web applications. It's always the classic model of request response, database backend, front end client, and then the specialized books maybe. But I guess, what if in the world of SPAs, shouldn't we have given every new engineer not a book on web application development, but maybe a book on native macOS, iOS, whatever development where you have to manage the life cycle of your app? Like, how would that have changed things?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's definitely an element to all of this of maybe a way to summarize this, the current state of web application development is that we are aggressively getting the worst of both worlds of like reasonable designs. There's the like very client heavy, very thin, like backend world that makes sense and has its own set of use cases that it's really good for. And then there's the exact opposite, which is where you have essentially very, very little client state, as little as possible, possibly even none, as close to static rendering as possible, cache things on CDNs as much as possible. And then, you know, the server is doing a lot more work. And then what we have instead is it's like, well, what if you had an extremely complex client that didn't need to be extremely complex? And then also you had a server that was not trying to output things that can be cached at all, even though many of them can be. Until like maybe you get like really far down the line, you just can't avoid it caching because you're just so big or whatever. Sounds like we're on the same page with this. Like fundamentally, web development seems to have progressed in some ways, but in a lot of ways really gone backwards.
Yeah. I'll add the big disclaimer that I don't know what's going on. I'm missing a lot of things. I've been too out of the game on the front end side of things, but coming back to it, it does feel incredibly complicated.
Yeah. We didn't even get to talk about Zed, but maybe I'll have to save that for another episode because we've been talking for a while.
Yeah.
That's also a project that I think is really cool. I'm excited about. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining me. This is really fun. We started off with compilers and ended up in modern web development.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice. This is where I'm coming from, you know, web development. It's
for
nice
sure.
to talk about
for
both.
Sure. And we also got some stuff to talk about next time. So thanks cool. so much for taking the time. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.